dress like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Day, right?
You see a lawyer on the weekend, and if they're you know, wearing anything fancier than they're in pants.
The Interim House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will come to order. We will start today with a very important announcement by our Legislative Revenue Office Director, yes. Dr. Paul Werner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome back to the Capitol, everybody. I just want to introduce our new intern, Allison Kibbe, who is here with us this summer. This is her second day. She's back in Oregon from Scripps College in California. She's going to work with us this summer. Her major is environmental economics. So,
welcome aboard, Allison. We've had very good luck with interns, and I can tell already that the streak will continue. Okay, we will get right to it. We have our forecast today, so let's call up our usual suspects to get the ball rolling.
One other thing, Madam Chair, if I may, Corinne reminded me to make sure the audience remembers to refresh. So that you'll get the forecast that's just been released on OLAS. So if you need to refresh your browser.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Mark McMullen, the State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, joined today by my colleague Josh Lehner, to give you yet again the quarterly economic and revenue forecast, which just went to sleep on me. There we go. So, in general, it was a really tough April for income tax states across the country. As we started to see the year-end April tax return payments come in, the returns were pretty disappointing relative to most expectations. In the typical state that's dependent on income tax, are in the Northeast or California and the like, we saw declines in payments on the order of 20-25% in the typical state. And Oregon itself was not immune to this. As we went throughout the tax year, the collections of final payments continued to get worse and worse. And what was behind this was largely taxpayers' behavior attempting to pull forward their taxable income into 2012 ahead of upcoming expiring Bush tax cuts that were allowed to drop off during the fiscal cliff debate in Washington, D.C. And so those of you who have been to these meetings before have heard us harp on this for several years now, the concern about this drop-off after the pull forward into 2012, where there's less taxable income in 2013, and it certainly happened. And while this was worse than we thought in terms of the decline in income tax payments, luckily while the payments out were smaller than we, or payments in were smaller than we thought, the payments out were smaller than we thought as well, in terms of income tax refunds that we paid out to tax holders. So on that, it turns out that we're still right on track with the close of session forecast in terms of where the revenues that are coming in the door are. We're just about right on, spot on with the close of session forecast. So as a result, no emergency budget cuts or credit issues are going to arise here like we're seeing in some of our other income tax dependent states. But that said, while we're really tracking with the forecast, in terms of the economic outlook, we're not. The economic outlook is becoming stronger as we talk to our advisory groups and others out there. A broad consensus across industries and ideologies and regions of the state are becoming more optimistic about the potential for economic growth in fiscal 15 and beyond. And so as a result, the overall revenue forecast is up a bit as well. With more jobs, we get more expected revenue. The first chart here shows what we've seen in terms of this acceleration in employment growth. As this is really, other than the magnitude of this acceleration, it's really playing out according to script. We felt that as a couple of the weights lifted on the economy, in particular housing turned from a drag to a driver, and we started seeing slow cuts in state and local government, that we would start to see the recovery broaden across regions of the state, and we would see an overall acceleration. And that certainly happened here in the recent past, over the past year. In fact, here, if you look at a 6 months employment growth, we're up to 3% year over year. This is the peak where we got during the housing boom years. We spent 2 years at about 3% growth. And we're there again now, albeit not, we haven't been there very long. And so this is a bit stronger than what we assumed in the close of session forecast, which is below, where we topped out at about a three-quarter throttle recovery. Now, we think over the long haul, we do feel, you know, over the medium term or longer term, we feel strongly that we're not going to see the same rates of growth that we've become accustomed to in past expansions. Largely because of the demographic weight on the economy, we expected, you know, the typical year of growth in Oregon now not to match the boom years of the 90s or the mid-2000s. But that said, it doesn't rule out the fact that we could have a couple of really good years. And at that point, since we're right now pretty close to the kicker threshold, that terrible K word may indeed come into play. So to discuss a little bit further the reasons for the acceleration and why we've been wrong so far or are underestimating this, I'll pass it along to Josh, who develops our Oregon model.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, members of the committee, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. The graph you see on the right there is the housing sector. And housing related, this includes mill workers, it includes loggers, it includes real estate agents, home improvement stores, and the like. With our detailed industry-level forecast, we're trying to decompose our errors to see what is driving the stronger-than-expected employment growth across the state of Oregon. And if you look at a lot of the usual suspects, professional business services, healthcare, government jobs, things like that, the forecast actually was quite has performed quite well over the last year. What's driving this larger-than-expected job gains is this housing-related industries. We had it growing somewhere in the neighborhood of twice as fast as the average sector. We knew the housing recovery would continue, would increase. We'd gain some more mill workers here in the state. It turns out it's come in over three times as fast as the average industry in the state, and that's what you saw on the graph on the right. You see the actual three times faster, 9% growth for housing-related industries. A lot of it has to do with some of the non-residential side of construction. We have the second phase of the Intel expansions going full bore right now out in Hillsboro. We have a new light rail line going in the Portland metropolitan area. So there's some non-residential type activity that's driving some of these construction job gains. But with that being said, across all of our goods-producing industries, manufacturing, construction, logging, and the like, the jobs have come in above forecast. We have underestimated some of these goods-producing jobs, which is good news throughout the state of Oregon. And if we go to the next slide, we can see that this acceleration in job growth in the state is due to regions outside of the Portland metropolitan area. You can see here over the last 30 years, Portland versus non-Portland Oregon, not to, you know, pit them against one another, have largely tracked each other in terms of rates of growth over the last 30 years. There have been two exceptions where there have been divergences in the rates of growth. The first was the 2001 high-tech-induced recession, hit the Portland metropolitan area disproportionately hard relative to the rest of the state and relative to the country, given the clustering of high-tech firms there. And then the second phase where the two growth rates have diverged is in 2010, 11, 12, coming out of the Great Recession, job growth returned to Portland first and strongest, like it did to many other large metropolitan areas in the country. The larger the city, the better you performed in the recovery across the country, by and large, with a few exceptions being Detroit and Cleveland and in the Rust Belt and places like that. But in the last year, 2 years, we've seen this strong job growth acceleration outside of the Portland metropolitan area. And right now, if we go to the next slide, four out of five counties in Oregon are seeing job gains. The rate of growth is not necessarily what we've become accustomed to. It's still a little bit of a step down, a half speed, three-quarters throttle relative to what we're used to in some of the non-metropolitan areas of the state. But still, four out of five growing in any given year or at any given point in time over the past year is roughly on par with what we've seen in previous expansions in the state. So the growth really has spread across some industries and across the state. So the economic expansion is starting to take hold. Again, the growth rate isn't quite there, but it is accelerated in the past 12, 18 months or so. And then in terms of where we are in the business cycle, in terms of getting back to where we were just before the crash, you can see here is our standard return to peak employment growth. What you do is you start in the upper left-hand corner. That's when you were at your peak employment level. As you follow the lines downward, that's the percentage of all jobs that were lost during that recession. As you make your way back up towards the zero line, that's the expansion kicking in, and you regain all your jobs once you get back to the 0%. You can see here in Oregon, unfortunately, we've had two great recessions, if you will. The early 1980s was the timber restructuring and the housing downturn, where the Federal Reserve raised interest rates up to 12%, mortgage rates were 18%. Nobody was buying homes, building homes, and there was no need for some of our loggers and our mill workers at that point in time. And what's interesting about comparing the 1980s to where we are today, not only are we in the same spot, relatively speaking, in terms of employment, the pattern that we get there is a little bit different. Typically, in a lot of previous expansions, you got an accelerated boost at the beginning of the recovery, a cyclical expansion as the manufacturing and the construction workers came back online as interest rates were lowered. We got the cyclical boost, and you can see that there in that blue line coming out of, you know, 3 years into the recession. That would be the end of 1982 or so. We got a really strong growth rates for a couple years and then kind of slowed down to this pattern we're seeing now. What's unique about this expansion is we had a really slow growth rate in 2010, 11, 12, and it's accelerating up to this sort of mediocre average rate of growth that you're seeing there in the red line. So getting this acceleration midstream, mid-expansions, what's a little bit unique about it, and again, a lot of it was anticipated with housing and government turning from drags to drivers, as Mark discussed before, but we're 2% below, or 1.5% below where we were back at 2007, and we're nearly back to pre-recession levels in terms of employment across the state. One more comparison with the early 1980s, you can see here, you know, not only are we there in terms of jobs, we're there in terms of the unemployment rate, both at the U3, which is sort of the standard unemployment rate measure, and then the broader U6, which includes some of the discouraged workers and those working part-time for economic reasons and things like that. We're largely in the same boat we are today that we were back in 1987. That doesn't sound so good, I understand, right? You know, everyone thinks the 80s as being a pretty dark period for the state of Oregon, but nevertheless, we came out of the 80s in decent shape by the 1990 recession hit. We were in okay condition, and then of course the 1990s were a boom period. We're not projecting that the 2020s are going to be anything comparable to the 1990s, but part of it goes to show that we just don't know necessarily what will be that driver of growth. And it's important to remember that our manufacturing industry is in a very similar position today that it was back then as well. Had lost 25% of its jobs in a severe recession, and it's gained somewhere about a third of them to a half of them back. And it wasn't until 1996 that we had regained all our manufacturing losses from the early 80s. So keep that in mind. You know, our manufacturing sector is doing quite well from a historical manufacturing point of view. Of course, we're at the lowest level of manufacturing jobs we've seen in quite some time, and productivity continues to increase in that sector. But overall, again, things are moving, things are improving, the growth is spreading across the state, and that's what these graphs are designed to show.
So it truly is remarkable how closely we've mirrored this business cycle from the 1980s as we step back. The same picture doesn't hold at the national level. So the question really is, then, are we set the stage for more growth? Are we, as we were at that point, are we coming to into a time when we, you know, where we are set to grow, we are set to accelerate, at least in terms of outperforming the U.S. as a whole? You know, to what extent are we positioned for this? And there are really a couple of narratives out there when we talk to our advisory groups. Oregon has had really four distinct eras in the last 40 years in terms of employment growth. In the late 60s, early 70s, and throughout the 70s, we were growing a lot faster than the average state, and in large part as we were drawing in a ton of skilled workers. We were bringing in workforce from other states, in particular educated workers, and that those labor force increases and the labor market impetus was such that we grew much faster than the typical state and had a growth advantage in almost each and every year. That was followed by the 80s, which Josh described, where we had a roller coaster ride, a very, very volatile economy that only kept up with the U.S. as a whole as we lost major manufacturers, followed by the 90s, a boom period. When we gained the manufacturers, again, we had accelerated population growth, but at that time, of course, we also saw the creation of the technology industries and the manufacturers in the Portland area, And then that was followed by a period in the 2000s where we just kept up with the U.S. and we had a lot of shocks to manufacturers and the volatility, again, a bouncy economy. So the question is, what's the underlying real Oregon economy? Is it those periods in the 2000s and the 80s when we were extremely volatile and just able to just keep up with the U.S. as a whole, or is the anomaly, or is the true period this growth advantage that we saw in the 70s and the 90s? And you can really make a case for both. Is it a good shock that hits the economy in the 70s in terms of the labor force dynamic and a good shock that hit the economy in the 90s in terms of the technology industries taking root? Or is it a story of bad shocks, where Oregon has a comparative advantage in the typical year because it's a draw to migrants and its location and its low energy costs and the like? And what happens is that it maintains a growth advantage over the U.S. unless we get hit by a big, bad manufacturing shock. We're still a manufacturing state, and it takes a long time to overcome those shocks. When the 1980s we took it, and then it takes 10 years before you're over it. And the same thing happened with the tech recession and Great Recession following it. And so that's really the story. And if we're in the world where we're just a middling state and waiting for something, the next big event to happen, it becomes difficult to put that in the forecast or to figure out what the next great thing is. But I think the other narrative is a bit more appealing to me insofar as we've really seen this experience in Oregon that we do tend to do better, largely because of our migration trends, unless we get hit where it hurts, which is the manufacturing industries. And I think an example right now is the Eugene metropolitan area, being the one large metropolitan area that really has not recovered to any meaningful extent so far in this business cycle, and that has large to do with the manufacturing losses that happened at the beginning of the recession there. Eugene lost 10,000 well-paying manufacturing jobs in the RV industry and in their tech manufacturing plant. And as a result, 10 years later, we're not seeing a lot of pizza parlors opening up and the like. And that really is par for the course with these kind of shocks. So if we're free of shocks, which right now appears we are, perhaps we will grow faster, and the real reason why, the biggest comparative advantage we draw to is really our migration trends over time. So I'm going to take a couple of minutes to talk about that before I go into the detail on the revenue forecast. Here we're looking at migration rates, the share of the population that moves in and out for both male and female across age groups. And the only thing to note here is in Oregon, the in-migrants outnumber the out-migrants for each and every age group. It's not just young folks moving to town here. It's not just retirees coming from California. It's really across the board. Our largest advantages are in the young adults. These are as you see here, those are the cohorts that, of course, move the most as they leave the nest and they get a job and they set roots in areas. And we still certainly have appear to have a great advantage at attracting those households, which are really the gold standard for regional economic development. The pattern has really been the same since the dawn of time. Here we're looking at IRS income data, and this was from the housing boom years, which was a typical expansion year in Oregon after the 2000s or whatnot. And you see this flow we've seen, it really is stable across time in terms of a lot of income coming from all across the U.S., but predominantly California, up into Oregon, and then we lose some in terms of net migration up to Washington and Idaho and Canada, although those numbers aren't here. So here in a typical year, we were netting $764 million, $700 million of it coming from California, and losing some $138 million worth of income to Washington. As we've gone forward and we had the housing crash, a lot of these migration flows short-circuited, and we didn't see the traditional flow of migrants here, despite the fact that we did have some job opportunity advantages vis-a-vis California. Here we move on to the most recent data we have is only 2010 and 2011, and you see the flows have slowed significantly, cut in a third in terms of California, but from anecdotal evidence, this population data is notoriously slow in coming out and lagged. But from all of our early indicators in terms of van lines and school registrations and DMV records and the like, it certainly appears that this flow back into Oregon of Californians has picked back up in recent years, which is of course really key to this, not only bringing in the younger skilled workforce as our population ages, but also bringing in demand in the form of retiree households, a lot of which are moving to some of our most economically distressed areas in southern Oregon and the coast. It's hard for us to get a handle on the exact economic impact of some of these folks, and so that's what we're focusing on right now with a lot of our effort. Are these two groups, the group of retirees moving from California to Southern Oregon, to what extent does their wealth matter for the regional economies there? We're good at measuring current income, what people are making today, but we're not as good at measuring wealth, which is what a lot of the retiree households have. And for the negative extent, we're also looking at the flows up to Washington in terms of to what extent are we losing wealth to Washington because of some tax advantages and the like. But it looks like our comparative advantage has come back, which is certainly wonderful. Here's one way of looking at it. Here we're looking at an odds ratio. So we compare people who move in and out of the state based on education level. So all of these are normalized to someone who does not have a high school diploma. So what are the odds of someone moving relative to someone with a high school diploma? So for in-migrants, someone moving in is twice as, with an associate's degree, is twice as likely to have moved in than someone with a less than a high school degree. So as you see here, movers in general, whether they're into or out of the state, are as we increase levels of educational attainment, we also increase mobility. People have more options, and they move more often as you go up the educational scale. But as you see here, we certainly the odds of folks moving in rise much more rapidly than those out. We certainly do bring in a lot of folks from wonderful Ivy League institutions in California schools that we don't train ourselves, which is a wonderful comparative advantage, and it keeps our labor costs low for local businesses, and we have an ample supply of skilled labor. Most of our industries do not complain about that. What some people do complain about is that maybe some of the folks that move here aren't doing a whole lot. This is a stereotype I don't necessarily buy into, but interesting, similar odds ratios again. You see here in terms of folks in Oregon, are in-migrants much more likely to be twice as likely, an unemployed person is twice as likely to in-migrate as an employed person or not in the labor force. Now, some of this doesn't have to do with with slackers per se, but rather the composition of the households that move here. Households have a lot of kids, for example, that move here, they're not in the labor force. If they have a lot of retirees, they're not in the labor force. But I think it also does hint at some of the attractiveness that our state has. We do hear anecdotally and do see in the data that spouses are much more likely to move here without a job, or if someone without a job, if you're untethered to a metropolitan area, this is as good a place as any. And so it certainly appears in the data that our comparative advantage in terms of drawing migrants still persists, and now that we've seen this housing market come online, hopefully our growth advantage will persist as well. So with that, on to the meat of the presentation. We'll talk a little bit about the revenue forecast. And as I explained before, we're really tracking very close to close of session, but we've become a little bit more optimistic as a result of the stronger job growth assumptions. We've added about 10,000 jobs in Oregon relative to the close of session forecast, and that's created a little bit of an increase in the forecast here. Here you see how we've evolved. This would be our third quarterly forecast in a row that has been revised up but not by a significant amount. But while it hasn't been a large amount, we're getting awfully close to the K word again here. Here we've created a threshold for the personal income tax kicker. Just under $300 million is the 2% of those revenues where we would kick in the kicker law, which would result in an income tax credit paid when folks file their taxes in April of 2016. They would be getting a credit on their return at that point. But we're not there yet. For now, we're still in this sweet spot between 0 and 2% where it would look like we would be able to the state would be able to use the additional resources for now. Obviously, we still have another April to go. And we've done a little decomposition here to show how we've eaten into that space. Half of our cushion that we've eaten into has been as a result of legislative changes that took place during the special session. Those revenue increases, although the intent of the kicker law was to make the revenue, any tax changes or law changes neutral, the letter of the law is very specific about what constitutes the close of session forecast being the law changes that were made during the regular session. And so any of these February session or special session changes do play into the kicker calculation. So that eats a chunk of our cushion away, roughly $93 million worth of general fund cushion. And then you see the other half of the cushion has to do with our forecast. The 20% of it is the fact that we've got about $30 million more of these resources than we expected at the close of session forecast, not a statistically large amount, but still $30 million. Is significant from a spending perspective, and then even more so this increase in optimism or the a larger, stronger economic outlook. So that said, now that we've become more optimistic about 2015 and beyond, we really do have an aggressive forecast underlying this 2015 number now, and so there is some downside risk as well. While we're here, $73 million or $74 million away from this kicker threshold, we've set the bar pretty high, and so it would take a pretty extraordinary year to get there. Although that again is not out of the question, as it appears we are starting off very well. What also started off very well was our income tax season. Again, this was the experience of many states. Here we look at the tracking of these year-end payments that come in with our tax returns or as extension payments throughout 2014 is the dark blue line. And as you see here, we really don't, it's hard to know what's happening until we get into May. At this point, we were over 3 weeks into April, we were still up 10% year over year on our tax payments, right along the line of our forecast target. Unfortunately, it's petered out rapidly since then, as it has in other states, and it looks like we're going to land just about where the typical state did, which is going to be, you know, somewhere in the order just under $100 million low. South of the forecast here, when all is said and done. But luckily, although we took in fewer payments than we expected, we also gave out fewer payments than we expected in terms of refunds. Here's our refund picture, which is considerably less than the last 2 years in terms of the amount of refunds that went out. We have a few explanations for this, but as you see, it looks like we're going to be at about the same, but this time $100 million to the good. So on net, it looks like we survived this April season right along the lines of expectations. And I'd like to think that it's just the composition of payment here, payments versus refunds. It was just, you know, a technical issue, but I think it's more fundamental than that. I think we really did overestimate the amount that our wealthy taxpayers were going to pay out of investment incomes and the non-wage type of income, but we underestimated how much our standard typical wage-earning household was going to owe in terms of their tax liability. And those standard wage-earning households are the ones who dominate the refund payments. So I think it was a mix issue, but the god of offsetting errors came to rescue us. And we luckily are, like I say, we're really kind of in line with expectations for now. One place that's at risk is corporate, ever-volatile corporate collections. We've seen
in April, a big jump up after huge refund payments at the beginning of the year. Corporate taxes were falling by 25-33% rates at the beginning of the year, and now they're growing at those same rates. Now, I don't know if this will persist. Our story in the past has been, as we start to see more expansion and hiring and acceleration, as we are seeing now, that this would pull down profits as firms expanded and hired and invested, that we'd see less profits, less corporate collections. I'm not so sure that's the case anymore. We now have, with the tax reform, we now also care about sales and not just profits. And so there may be an issue there as well in terms of the fact that as we expand and the sales growth we're seeing is also picking up the corporates. But right now we have refunds muddying the waters. We've had some really large spikes in refunds, not all associated with our court cases. And so we're going to have to wait and see over the next couple of months to see where the corporate collections land. But luckily, these are on a smaller scale than the personal income taxes. So while it's volatile, it doesn't make the same kind of budgetary hit. And that, and we've now dedicated what used to be the corporate kicker to education spending. For that, we're about $16 million away from the threshold, while corporate taxes are lower than we expected at the close of session. Again, there were legislative changes that muddied the waters, in particular during the special session. There was a shift of some of these Measure 67 rainy day fund deposits that was shifted, and some of that was shifted into the general fund in the current biennium. As a result, general fund corporate collections are running ahead of forecast, even though the underlying receipts are not. But it's clearly a pull forward issue, this idea of wealthy taxpayers pulling their income into 2012 to in advance of increases in tax rates at the federal level. Here you see information from the match returns. We have about 80-90% of our returns matched now. Unfortunately, not all the high-end folks are matched, because those are the complicated returns, are the last ones that are put in often in the fall. But that said, we're starting to get a picture here, and the picture for income growth in 2013 was different depending on the tier of taxpayers. The dark bars here are taxpayers who have been affected by Measure 66. That's roughly the top 2.2% of filers in terms of income. And so someone who was affected by Measure 6 in either of the 2 years, 2012 or 2013, these high-income tax filers can sometimes come in and out of the records as their income is very volatile from year to year. But we see, of course, for these Measure 66 types who pay roughly a quarter of income taxes, dividends, taxable IRAs with Roth conversions, capital gains, and the like, these flexible types of income are down 20-25%, and that's what's hitting our coffers. On the upside, we're seeing the folks not affected by Measure 66 seeing quite a bit of gains in their liability. In particular, the capital gains among folks in the lower income tiers increased by a good 50-60% in keeping with the rapid stock market growth we saw. So this you know, it's all the non-wage forms of income that really lead to our the difficulty in forecasting. Here is the growth in these year-end personal tax payments that we've seen over the past decade or so. And the double-digit growth is normal. We've seen increases and declines on the order of 40-50% in the largest swings. And we're expecting a pretty good growth in 2015, as you see here now. While we don't expect capital gains, realizations, and investment income to keep up with the stock market, the stock market is booming, and it's very, very difficult to keep our models for calling for a lot of growth. But they've been right in the recent past. We got it right in 2011 and 2013 at those high growth rates, and hopefully that this one will as well. But we're sticking out our neck a little bit here as we go into 2015. Hopefully the forecast will match it as well. Here we see the capital gains realizations, which is the biggest part of those investment incomes. Here, there's quite a bit of growth we're looking for here over the next few years. You see this 2013 hangover, but we don't have that lasting for very long. Again, these aren't keeping up with the underlying stock prices, which are the red bars, but nevertheless, the market gains have really been enormous. And so we do have quite a bit of growth built into our forecast. The concern here would be both on the upside and the downside. So it's the non-wage income really creates a tremendous amount of volatility in our income stream. This chart, I don't want to get too deep into the details, but it basically looks at the historical swings in revenue and growth in revenue from 85 to the current period. With us, Oregon, an income tax state, vis-a-vis Washington, our neighbor, a sales tax state with a relatively similar industrial structure and migration trends as we have. And as you see here, our revenues are more volatile. Washington's over that time has varied from about plus 14% to minus 10% a year, where our revenues fluctuate from plus 16 to minus 16. So we have had a more volatile revenue stream. You see the two middle quartiles are the boxes in the middle. But while we've had more volatility, I try to point out as often as I can to folks that are interested in the revenue reform or the rating agencies who happen to be calling a lot about exposure to income taxes and capital gains in the last few weeks, the fact that, you know, that you worry about return as well as risk. We have a very volatile revenue stream in terms of personal income taxes, but we do take in quite a bit more in the average year than a sales tax or some of these other revenue instruments here. Here you see the median year, 7.5 for us versus 5.6 in Washington. So it really becomes a management problem. To what extent can we manage this volatile revenue stream across the budget cycle? So given that, you know, returns are important and they're going to be more important going forward because we have a lot of structural issues facing state tax instruments as the population ages, and Josh is going to mention a couple of those briefly.
We've talked a lot about in our office and in our forecast about the slower growth moving forward, slower economic growth, slower revenue growth, primarily attached to the demographic changes, right? So as the largest cohort, the baby boomers, start to enter into the retirement years. They've already started a little bit. We're losing very productive workers. They're our largest, most educated, wealthiest, most productive generation we've ever seen. It's going to result in slower economic growth and slower income growth for the state and across all states. It's not just, obviously not just an Oregon-specific issue. And what you see here is that as you age, spending and income both go down, right? You know, almost by definition, for the vast majority of people, your retirement income is less than what you earned during your peak earning years. And so that results in less spending and less taxable income, and it's across a whole host of categories, and you see that in the graph on the right, somewhere in the magnitude of 20 to 30% decline in spending across all these different household expenditure categories. And typically, you know, you think about this, well, we're not a sales tax state, that's not going to impact us so much, but if you look at a lot of those bars down in the lower green bars, those look a lot like other funds, right? Revenue for tuition, you know, retirees, they might take the odd pottery course at a community college for some extracurricular activities. But they're not, you know, going to school, and the millennials are starting to age out of their college years. The bulk of them are kind of in their mid-20s to 30 now, if you will. And so some of these other funds, the liquor receipts and the tobacco receipts and things like that, it's going to impact our revenue streams across a whole host of categories here in the state of Oregon, even though we're not a sales tax state. So it's just important to keep an eye on that. And so this is what's underlying a lot of our slower growth moving forward, these types of changes. And then lastly, just want to talk about the border tax differential. As we've discussed a little bit before, the tax rate differential between the state of Washington and the state of Oregon seems to be a very, very large deal in terms of cigarette sales. State of Washington has a lot of contraband cigarettes in their state, given their really high tax. We sort of have a more average level of taxation on cigarettes. But right now we're outselling the state of Washington on a number of packs sold. By a good chunk. You can see there the green bars way above the blue line. And you know, our population Washington is not quite is a little bit more than half of what state of Washington is, and the smoking rates are about the same, somewhere in the 18 to 20% smoking rate for the adult population. So the tax behavior and the taxpayer behavioral shifts seem to be driving quite a lot of this. And then the most recent part of the grand bargaining with the increase in the tobacco tax or the cigarette tax in the state of Oregon, you can see what that does to the red line there. It drops it just a little bit with a 13-cent increase in the tax per pack. So the tax differential between Washington and Oregon barely budged, even though we just raised ours a little bit. And now Washington, I'm hearing from counterparts up north that they're talking about adding another dollar to their tax rate. And so we would suspect that would be an upside risk to tobacco receipts here in the state of Oregon in the near term, at least.
And we're seeing a similar dynamic with the tax differential on liquor as well. So finally, we'll just do the upshot. Here is June 14th. This is the current 2013-15 biennium, for which the net available resources increased by $52.5 million. Now, actually, resources are down, I think, in the order of $70 million in terms of what's available for policymakers, since spending was increased during the special session as well. So the spending increase is not in that number. So unfortunately there isn't money to go around, but you can blame the budget director and legislative fiscal officer for that. So we have, as you see here, the ups and downs are on the right, as usual. We're seeing more jobs or more personal income taxes. That's the $45 million in additional personal income taxes for 2015 is as a result of our stronger job growth assumption. Also on the upside, $24.8 million in general fund reversions. As a rule, at the end of the biennium, which this would be the 11-13 biennium, to give themselves cushion and so that they don't have to come back to the legislature and ask for money, a lot of agencies have a little of their appropriation left over. And so what's left over of the appropriation from 11-13 gets swept into the general fund. That's in keeping with the size in past biennia. And finally, the other positive factor we see these refunds coming in lower than we thought. On the negative side, the February appropriations I mentioned, estate taxes are coming in below forecast. We revised them down again by $10 million this time. Other states are not seeing this. Other states with large estate taxes, particularly in the Northeast, are all talking about booms and how that's helping to offset their weak personal income tax. That's not the case for us. Estate taxes in Oregon are, over the last 6 months, are as low as they've been in a decade. I don't know if we're healthier or what, but no one's kicking off. Maybe it was the warm winter. Who knows? So at any rate, estate taxes are low. Final income tax payments are low, as we talked before, and the Shared Service Fund program, the estimates on that coming out of our business development group are roughly $5 million higher than they were last quarter. So across time here, you see because of those red bars, the personal income tax increase, which is pretty consistent over time. Again, we've added 10,000 jobs in the near term, and that compounds a little bit going forward. The black bar being the net, we've seen decreases in some other, most other tax sources, but 54.5 available resources this biennium, next biennium up $136 million, 89 in 17-19, and again in 19-21, and about $100 million in 21-23, largely due again to the job outlook. And as we always say, always end at the end, our long-term outlook is mild. As we see the retiring of a lot of our productive workforce, we're going to unfortunately not match the past in terms of the average year. It looks like we trend out at around 10% growth rates in general fund revenues for each biennium. In the past, when we've been in an economic expansion, we've been more in the 15-16% growth rates. So we don't expect to get there, but again, it doesn't rule out a couple of good, very good years in the meantime. And so stay tuned. And with that, happy to open it up to any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee. Well, I'll just make a comment. If you could stay within the 2% window with the kicker, you will tie the record set by Dr. Warner. It's only been done once. Is that correct, Paul?
No, they were, 1.1% last biennium.
Oh, you did it last biennium. So you will.
That was thanks to the legislative changes that I'm blaming now. Last biennium, without those, we would have been slightly under.
Well, then you will. So, if you can maintain this, you will break the record then.
Then we give them two in a row.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was slide 21, you were forecasting the capital gains revenue. And I was just dying of curiosity. The way that just sort of takes a 45-degree angle up for 10 years, are you actually forecasting consistent stock market increases over that period of time? Because I think people here might want to invest.
Yeah, Representative Conger, we try to keep the stock market forecast at arm's length because obviously. So we take that directly from our nationwide vendor. The nature of that outlook is strong growth this year, as we've already posted quite a few months of strong growth. They're looking at 14-15% growth this year, followed by, over the long run, growth in the order of 3-4% in keeping with nominal GDP growth, which is the typical assumption for stock markets. Now, obviously, that's not the history of stock markets. They go up and down. Here you see we have built in some cyclicality into the outlook for capital gains that's not there in the outlook for tax revenue, for stock prices as a result. But we have to pick an outlook. It's difficult to pick the timing of the turndown, so we like to outsource the stock market forecast and then impose our pessimism on the revenue stream instead.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your slide number 12, if you go to that. And I was hoping that perhaps you would have the portion of the counties that reflect the unemployed and not labor force. The reason I raise the issue is because Malheur County, being adjacent to Idaho, enjoys a $2 per hour higher minimum wage than does Idaho, and Oregon safety net is number 12 in the nation, and Idaho is number 50 or 51. And so I would like to see if this graph applied countywide reflects that. And then, Madam Chair, I have a second question, if I may.
Yes, please.
Your slide number 19, the matched 2013 tax returns, is this normal that we would not yet know the dividends, taxable IRAs, capital gains of that portion of the taxpaying group? Is this normal or is this unusual that we're still waiting to see the outcome of the 23% of the tax burden? Will we know, and I guess we will know, but is this unusual that we don't already know?
Representative Benz. So first question, we will dig into the county numbers. The data that underlie the chart about that is based on census micro data. So we do have county level data, not huge samples for some of our smaller counties, mind you, but we do have some county level data. So we'll follow up on that. In terms of the processing, we're running a little bit behind the typical processing, but this is usually what does occur. Our wealthiest taxpayers send in a check on April 15th, but then go work with their accountants and put together the return. It's an amended or return or an extended return by the end of the day in September. We'll start to see that. But that said, we do have roughly 60% of our capital gains revenue in so far. We have like 90% of our wages in, so it depends on the source, and that's standard for the timing. So unfortunately, we're working with what we have here. The numbers probably won't land exactly here, but at the end of the day, we will see these dividends, taxable IRAs, and capital gains with large declines. Maybe not exactly these, but large declines.
Thank you.
sorry.
Please.
Did you say large declines?
Yes, for the high wage folks, as you see here. Obviously, there's a split performance there, but.
And why?
Because the reason there's a split performance is because high income and wealthy taxpayers have more flexibility with when they realize their income for tax purposes. When I earn my wage, they take a chunk out of my paycheck before I even see it. But if I'm earning capital gains in the stock market, I decide when to sell those gains and realize them for tax purposes. And so with these flexible issue, dividends are turned out to be flexible as well. I think some of the folks on these board of directors were also taxpayers. We have taxable IRAs. We had a Roth conversions that people tried to do to get in front of tax increases, and then capital gains, of course, are very flexible in terms of when you sell them, typically. And so that's why we see this big volatility in that group.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're on, go back to 11 and 12, the brain gain and the migration data. A couple of rounds ago, you made some interesting comments about the split between what's going on in the rural economies in Oregon and what's going on in the metro. And I guess I'm asking, in this data of immigration of well-educated workforce people, are we seeing gains in those areas where we really have seen deep aging and lack of jobs outside of the metro areas? Do you see hope there? Do you see gain there?
Yeah, Representative Berger, unfortunately, the results mixed depending on which rural community we're talking about. I make the mistake of talking about rural Oregon as if it's one big entity.
And that's fair that it is not, but you get at my question.
Yes, yes. And so these migration trends are not just helping the Portland metropolitan area. Like I say, southern Oregon and some of the coast are really starting to benefit from migration, and, you know, despite the fact that their job markets remain pretty weak in some of their core industries. We saw some improvement in migration in the Northeast as well, but that is very much place to place. Umatilla is growing great, Pendleton not so much, you know. So there still are pockets, Southeast Oregon, Klamath County. There's some pockets that unfortunately aren't seeing much in terms of population growth yet.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you both. And I also want to plug, as always, Josh's excellent blog, which gets a lot of play in the press now for a good reason. I appreciate you putting in context this data with Oregon's historical data, but I didn't see a whole lot of comparison this time with United States in general. A couple slides maybe you could add verbally. What are the blue chip indicators, one you've often done in the past? Where does your economic outlook compare with the other economists that you talk to, and where has Oregon's recovery been and going compared with the rest of the country?
Thanks, Representative Davis. Our vendor, Global Insider, IHS Economics now, they rebranded, is they're right about at the middle of the blue chip consensus, which calls for an acceleration of employment growth at the U.S. level. Now, right now, we're a good percentage point ahead in terms of growth of the U.S. growing around 2%, and we're growing around 3%. There's a big growth differential. That part of that has to do with the U.S. as a whole had real bad weather this winter, and some of our acceleration is probably the fact that we had a milder winter. But we've certainly outstripped the rest of the country over the last 6 months. Now, the question for our advisors became, well, now if the consensus of blue chip forecasters and everyone else out there expects the U.S. economy to pick up, do we take another step up as a result? And that's an open question. Right now, we do not have that in there, partly because the reason we've had such strong growth has been tied to these outstanding housing numbers that Josh showed that probably aren't sustainable over the long run. But we stay posted because, again, a couple of big years, particularly given Oregon's history, are not out of the question.
Thank you.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that this seems like a great Rose Festival week forecast because it's generally sunny with some chance of rain, is what I would say. But I did want to follow up on Representative Bent's comment about the minimum wage and the effect on Eastern Oregon, because there was a New York Times article a few weeks ago that talked about how many people just across the border are working in Oregon because of the minimum wage here. And so it seems like, though, you know, it's not necessarily that these are the jobs that everybody wants to have. Clearly, for people in Idaho, they do want to have these jobs. They want to have them here in Oregon. And, you know, I always think it's part of the path for people that are working hard to escape poverty. So I just wondered if you had a comment on that.
Yes, Senator Rosenbaum. Yeah, I did think it always rained at the Rose Festival parade. Let's say, but at any rate, yeah. In terms of low wage jobs, sometimes low wage jobs get a bad rap. I think we talk about, we worry about, we want to add jobs that are above the average pay and things like that. Otherwise, we're reducing in somehow, you know, the per capita income or something of Oregonians. And I think that's misleading in a way. Insofar as if I want to take a low wage job, it's probably because it's a better opportunity than my other opportunities. So if I'm cobbling together $10,000 a year in part-time work and I get a $20,000 minimum wage job, well, average income goes up. Even though I'm taking a relative low-wage job, average income goes up. So in general, I think any job is a good job. That's, of course, abstracting away from the debate about the proper size of the minimum wage and what's a living wage or whatnot. But abstracting away from that, really, almost any job is a good job.
Thank you.
Senator Bertrand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at your long-term revenue forecast, wouldn't that significantly change if we've seen our housing market slow down because of inflation and or higher interest rates?
Yes, Senator. That is the case. Now, we do have some slowing in the housing as a result of Fed tightening going forward, but our outlook is that that will be a very orderly process, and that and we've already seen that that might not be the case. When the Fed first announced that they were thinking about tapering and starting the process, we saw a big jump in mortgage rates right away and the housing market sputter. So there's a large degree of concern among many of our advisors that this will be anything but an orderly process, and we may well short-circuit the recovery. But abstracting away from the downside, this is pretty modest rates of growth. So if we are able to maintain an expansion at the U.S. level, I'm pretty confident that we've set the bar not too high here at 10% a biennium. Even if we don't have a whole, even if it's, you know, this is more disappointing than a typical expansion.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both. I recognize that the magnitude of changes in corporate receipts pale in comparison to the personal, but I also recognize that they are connected, and I can't ever get past the increased volatility in corporate relative to personal. Now, when you were going through the corporate volatility, it felt like you maybe had something more to say about that relationship and about what you've observed that you expected or didn't expect. I wondered if you had more to say there.
Yeah, thanks, Representative Reed. Yeah, you sense, you know, the level of discomfort with the corporate collections. In general, if you stand back, our corporate collections have really been pretty steady at somewhere around $400 million a year for 15, 20 years. They've been twice that or half that in a given year, but they've fluctuated around a level of around $400 million a year. Well, going forward, and now we've taken a step up from that. Now we're up to $500-$600 a year, and going forward, we maintain that higher level.
The argument being that we had a lot of tax reforms. We had first the single sales factor, and then Measure 67 come along, which increased the effective tax rates on corporations. But since those reforms, we've had a very volatile time. We've had a great recession, and it's hard to see where we're going to land. And so abstracting away from the volatility, the up and down swings, the real question is what's the underlying corporate tax liability look like? And right now, we're expecting it to be somewhat higher than it has throughout Oregon's history. But that's an open question and leads to some discomfort.
Thank you.
And batting cleanup, Chair Barnard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a very parochial question and then a more general one. The parochial one is you made a comment about Eugene and Lane County being behind the curve, as it were. What kind of outlook do you see for that area in the near future, and how does that fit into your forecast? Second question is my usual one. Your analysis of the upside and downside risks for for the forecast that you've given us. What are the odds of it being too low? What are the odds of it being too high, and why?
Representative Barnard, I think in terms of the Eugene regional economy, I think most of that the pain is over. I do believe that Eugene is going to come online soon. In particular, the university is clearly bursting at the seams. It was likely to be expansion over the next several years, which would be a nice stimulus. Also, we're starting to see those migration trends turn around as well. And so if we can get in households as well, growth should pick up going forward. So I think I'm pretty bullish about Eugene. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the metropolitan area. I think it was just that manufacturing shock was so dramatic. And then going forward in terms of the risks, our vendor, again, has a balanced risks right now, 20% upside, 20% downside. These are the same sort of factors that have been there before. On the upside, we have stronger than expected housing market recovery or spending recovery by consumers and or labor force growth. Return of some of these discouraged workers into the labor force now that job opportunities are available. On the downside are typically the external shocks. We still talk about Europe and China. The new one on that list is Ukraine, but I don't have anything interesting to say about Ukraine per se.
Okay. That's a relief.
Could I ask one more?
Please follow
one more
up.
Thank you. We keep seeing in the news more and more about innovation and productivity gains and how that affects the economy. I mean, the argument seems to be productivity gains happen because for a whole bunch of reasons, a lot of them having to do with technological changes, and that results in fewer less job growth because a worker can produce more. We also see predictions about changes in the economic mix and concerns about things like climate change, global warming, that may force changes in the economic mix. Of course, Oregon is an import state when it comes to energy, a variety of other things. Do your gurus have any comments about how those kinds of factors are likely to affect the economy over the mid and long term, and what effect that might have on Oregon's economy and Oregon's growth rates? I realize that's a big question, but your thoughts about that today might be useful.
Representative Barnett, I lost the first part of your question somewhere, but the second part with the in terms of global warming, we're already seeing some impact across the state in keeping with this. Our agricultural producers, we have the big California winemakers, the big names that make, you know, the highest volume are buying thousands, thousands of acres in southern Oregon in anticipation of climate change.
Rogue Valley.
Yeah, in the Rogue Valley, and that's right, and also around Ashland, Medford, mm-hmm. up there. And so There has been some response. They're certainly talking about it in Northeast as well, and the agricultural producers there as well. But I think, you know, going forward, I think the industry mix will change in terms of technological change. You need technological change for economic growth over the long run. All of our models say that, particularly with our aging workforce and whatnot, we are tied to technological change, which isn't necessarily a bad thing because, as you say, each worker, we need fewer workers, but they produce more. The trick becomes, to what extent can we capture that value locally? To what extent is that value incorporated in the workers' pay, or to what extent does it leak to out-of-state shareholders or whatnot? You know, that's the question, is to what extent we're creating a lot more value. Capturing that value is the trick.
Madam Chair, I really like the way he describes that particular issue.
It sounds like we'll be a net gainer, potentially, with otherwise catastrophic climate developments. Other questions from the committee? Okay, we will go into recess. The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will go into recess until 9:25. And I want to thank you very much for the forecast. And we will reconvene here at 9:25.
Ditto for the House. House Committee on Revenue will reconvene.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will reconvene, and we will resume our agenda, which is tax compliance in Oregon, updated estimates from the Department of Revenue. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the respective committees. My name is John Hart. I'm a senior economist in the research section at the Oregon Department of Revenue, and the topic that I'm talking on today is compliance with Oregon's personal and corporate income tax programs. The impetus for the particular report that you'll find in OLIS today is a budget note from 2013. The budget note had two parts, and this report addresses the first part of the budget note, which asks for a report that describes the cause of noncompliance in personal and corporate income tax programs and includes a discussion of tax gap estimates for those programs.
14 session now.
So I like to think about tax compliance in three components. The IRS uses these definitions. The three components are filing compliance, which is filing the required reports on time, reporting compliance, which is accurately reporting the required information, and payment compliance, which is full and timely payment of any tax due. So those three components can be thought of as kind of the entirety of compliance or noncompliance. And there's not always a bright line separating compliance from noncompliance. In thinking about compliance, you can think of the motive for noncompliance and the opportunity for noncompliance. First, with the motive, the economic research has focused for many years on taxpayers knowing how much tax they owe and then thinking of their compliance as a gamble as to whether they'll get caught, and if they get caught, what that penalty would be. And so it's kind of like throwing the dice. If I think my chance of being caught is very low, or if the penalty for being caught is very low, then I might throw the dice. And that's kind of the basis of the pure economic motive. There's more research on a group of characteristics that might be broadly thought of as taxpayer morale, where people have social, political, or other reasons for complying or not complying. Rather than think of this just in the negative, you can think of kind of the social or political reasons. You might think that it's your patriotic duty to pay taxes, and so you're more compliant than you would be for purely economic reasons because of that duty, or because you have a duty to support schools or social services or government services. There's also taxpayer morale also may include the taxpayer who looks at the complexity of the tax code and says, I really don't have time to study this, or I don't have the resources to pay somebody to get my reporting perfectly right. And so just judging the effort required to comply, based on that, they may not comply. The Department of Revenue, and I think most researchers, believe that most noncompliance is accidental or inadvertent. Even though the cases that make the news are kind of the intentional noncompliance, and the dollars associated with intentional noncompliance may be higher, most instances of noncompliance are probably inadvertent. The opportunity for noncompliance we like to think of in two components. The first component is the visibility of income. And we see great correlation with compliance and income visibility. So where income is reported by third parties, so wage income is nearly all reported on W-2s, we see high compliance in reporting those wages because those wages are reported separately by both the taxpayer and by the payer of the income. And when you also have withholding, as in wages, then you have very high compliance because the withholding is typically designed to be a pretty good estimate of the tax due for that income kind of at the source. So we see wages and dividends and interest with good compliance, and then you see those kind of self-reported things, usually associated with small businesses, Schedule C, proprietor's income, and those types of things have lower compliance. The other opportunity for noncompliance comes in when you have complexity. When it's difficult for a taxpayer to understand what tax they owe, then they have an opportunity for noncompliance in that they may not have the resources or be able to take the effort to be compliant. And so just that kind of increased level of difficulty reduces compliance. And complexity also provides a way for those who are going to be intentionally noncompliant to kind of bury their noncompliance in a string of sub-entities or in overstating or understating net costs or revenues. The second part of the report that you have on all this talks about the tax gap, and it's a pretty thorough discussion of the tax gap. Importantly, if we knew what the tax gap was, if we could actually look at every taxpayer and measure how much noncompliance was associated with that taxpayer, it would be smaller. So we can't measure the tax gap. Not even the taxpayer typically knows if they were compliant as they file their return. You may have seen in the news right around tax time, Donald Rumsfeld sent an open letter to the IRS saying, I have no idea if I've paid the right tax. And I think a lot of taxpayers feel that way as they file. The only thing we can do in looking at the tax gap is to make rough estimates. And the methods that we use to make rough estimates can be of varying use, but the estimate that's made by Oregon's Department of Revenue is based on the IRS estimate, which looks at every component of income and estimates a net misreporting percent for those components of income. And so we have kind of a good estimate of the relative contribution to the tax gap of the different components of income and the different deductions and credits, but it's still relatively speculative. The other ways to estimate the tax gap are to look at survey data. The census does household surveys and asks household what their income was, and you can kind of create synthetic tax units and estimate what tax would be owed based on that survey data. There's a number of differences between the questions that census is asking about income and what income is actually taxable. And so there's pluses and minuses there. Also, survey data is obviously self-reported, and so it may not be accurate. The other source of tax gap estimates that states have used is looking at estimates of income produced by the Bureau of Economic Analysis at the federal level. They'll do state-level estimates of things like wages, and you can then look and see how much of the estimated wages appear on Oregon tax returns. The problem with that method is that a lot of people who have wages aren't required to file a tax return, and so the fact that those wages aren't reflected on tax returns may be indicative of noncompliance or may just be indicative of the tax structure itself. Oregon, as I mentioned, uses IRS estimates, and the IRS does a sample of about 50,000 returns and audits them in detail to make estimates of the compliance by return component. Their estimate for corporate level tax gap is not as detailed and comes from their regular operational data.
Representative Berger is dying to say something.
Did you just say that state level estimates of income types by the BEA can be off because wages are not necessarily reported? Who doesn't report wage?
Chair's representative.
Is that what you said? Did I mishear you?
There's some nuance in that. and so I'm not sure if you misheard me or if I misspoke, or if we have kind of the same understanding. But the BEA estimates total wages in a state, or total wages paid in a state. And if you look at tax returns, there are certain wage earners who earn low enough wages. Say you earn $100 in a week working at the summer fair or whatever. Somebody who earns $100 in a week working at the summer fair is generally not required to file a tax return if that's their only wage or if that's their only income.
But those are the ones that are missed.
And so those are not expected to show up on tax returns. And so there's kind of some compliant taxpayers, because they didn't have a filing requirement, they are compliant in not filing, whose wages will not show up
that has
on
got
tax returns.
Is that a very big number?
We don't know. It could be a fairly big number, because you have a lot of typically younger people who are earning lower than the exemption amounts and standard deduction, which is kind of the source of the filing requirements.
I one comment and then we'll move on.
Okay. I wish our young people all had jobs, but I doubt that they do.
Any job is a good job, as the previous speaker said. Chair Barnhart.
Just a quick follow-up. You don't, these numbers don't include in wages, I assume, maybe I'm wrong, the money which is paid to people who are actually employees but are treated as if they were subcontractors.
Mr. Chair, the reporting for those people, if they're reporting as they're being reported to, they're not being reported as wages.
Okay.
But some people will know that it should have been reported as wages and reported on the wage line. Again, there's a good amount of nuance in that.
You mean that the final income earner,
yes,
may report it accurately as wages, even though he was paid as if he were a subcontractor?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
That's all right. We're an open committee here. So proceed.
The another thing to know about the tax gap is that even if we were to have an accurate measure of the tax gap, much of the tax gap wouldn't be collectible. A lot of the Department of Revenue's accounts receivable seems to hinge on people's ability to pay. And so you'll see in the report a depiction of the accounts receivable, and you see that 30 or 40% of that accounts receivable is made up of debt that was self-reported by the taxpayer. And I actually can flip. I have some bonus slides. I like to do bonus slides. So you can see the level of personal income tax accounts receivable held by the Department of Revenue for the last 7 years. And you can see that a good portion of that is self-assessed, that blue portion of the bar at the bottom. And we think that these people are people who report that they owe tax, but they're just not able to pay. They've given us a signal that they want to comply, but they're not able to comply. And so this payment compliance is one component of the tax gap that is difficult to collect, because people were assessing an income tax after the income was earned, and if it's already spent, it's very hard for them to pay it in tax. You'll also note, and I'll take the opportunity now, the red line at the top of that, the enforced filing, is made up largely of what our department calls failure to file assessments, where we do the service to the taxpayer and file a tax return on their behalf with the income that we found for them. And as we file on the taxpayer's behalf, we know that this taxpayer hasn't filed. They've sent a signal, or they have not sent a signal, that indicates that they're noncompliant to begin with. But also, when the department estimates their tax, the department has to use the best available information and can't give them credit for all of the deductions or credits that they may be entitled to. So often, if a taxpayer files a return after we have filed one on their behalf, the amount of tax that they owe is lower than we estimated. And so a good portion of that red part of the accounts receivable is not collectible, partly because it's an estimate of what's owed as opposed to being what's actually owed. It's also pursuing people who have not tried to be compliant, very different than the blue part. And the smaller part in the middle, the deficiency that comes from audits and adjustments during return processing. And that's kind of somewhere in between on the enforcement So the in estimating the tax gap, we end up with a number that is inflated for a number of reasons. But one of those, with the personal income tax, the IRS has found that even after an intensive audit of a taxpayer, that they tend to only find about one-fourth of the reportable income on the lowest income visibility categories. So on farm income and proprietor's income, the IRS just doesn't have enough information to identify the total amount of tax that would be due even after an audit. And so they actually apply a factor to their estimate. If they find $100 in income that was misreported, for those lowest visibility categories, they apply a factor between 3 and 4. And so they'll say, we found $100. That actually means we believe there were $400, but 300 of those would be impossible to find. And they've actually used two methods to do that. In the early 80s, they actually withheld information returns. They withheld the W-2s on wages from auditors to test, as an auditor looked at wages, how much wages could they identify, and they found they could identify about one-fourth of the wages even without those returns. But now they use what they call a detection controlled estimate, which is some gnarly mathematical way of doing basically the same thing. And they find that multiple of about 4 is roughly the same for the lowest visibility categories. And so even if every taxpayer were intensively audited, there's some categories of income where you would only find one-fourth of the income that should have been reported or that was misreported. We've also seen a tendency, and it's a natural tendency, when you see two numbers, a number from one state and a number from another state, or two numbers from one state at different periods in time. We've seen those compared. And those comparisons are generally not meaningful for a number of reasons. A comparison over time is much more likely to reflect changes in the estimation methods or in the components of income that were reported than it is to reflect actual change in the tax gap. So, for instance, if you look at 2012 Oregon tax returns, you're going to see much more capital gains than you're going to see in 2013 or 2014, as I think you just heard in the forecast. And those capital gains have a lower compliance rate than wages. And so just that different mix of income sources means, as we look at them, we believe that compliance is lower for capital gains, and so lower in 2014 as a percentage of what should have been reported, or in 2012 than in 2013, for instance, just on the capital gains side. Comparisons across states are even more difficult, also more likely to reflect differing income tax sources. The tax structure itself has a huge bearing on the tax gap, and we've also seen a state that uses the survey data to make their tax gap estimate compared to a state that uses the IRS data to make their tax gap estimates. And just that differing method of estimation means that those comparisons probably reflect more the difference in estimation than the underlying tax gap. As an example of how a state's tax structure might affect the tax gap estimate, as we go through and look at income that's reported, we look at what's reported and we apply the IRS's net misreporting percent to it. So if we have two taxpayers, each with a estimated true income of $37,000 because they reported $33,300, in two different states, one with a 4% rate on income above $15,000 and one with a 6% rate on income above $20,000, your tax gap estimate can vary from 17% to 22% as a percent of the tax due to differences in those kind of exemption amounts underneath and to the rates. And you can actually see that the misstatement amount is in income is roughly the same, but it is exactly the same in that scenario, but it just translates in estimation to a bigger percent. So the Oregon estimates for the personal income tax gap, when applying the federal estimates, we estimate for tax year 2010 that the net gap was $1.1 billion. So $1.1 billion was unpaid that was owed. And for the corporate, which is, they're both speculative, but the corporate, if I could put a superlative on that, is extremely speculative. The net gap that we estimate there is about $70 million for tax year 2010. The value that that tax agencies get in seeing the tax gap really isn't from these big numbers. It's really from the knowledge that different sources of income, different credits, and different deductions have kind of differential rates of compliance, and that helps to focus enforcement resources.
The Department of Revenue is on the verge of getting new software, new machinery to help match state returns with federal returns. When that happens, do you see an improvement in that $1.7 billion tax gap?
Madam Chair, the estimate is not likely to change much. We do take into account the enforcement revenue that we receive after a reporting year. But the estimate's not likely to change much, but the ability for the department to pursue compliance should increase with an increase in technological capability.
So what does that mean? Does that mean more recovery, which would narrow the gap, or what does that mean?
Madam Chair, it's difficult to speculate exactly what the impacts are. I hate to do this, but I would refer you to Eric Smith if you have the manager of the Systems Replacement Project. If you have questions about what the kind of on-the-ground differences are going to be in strategy and operations.
Other questions? Chair Barger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to slide 9. Tax gap estimate comparisons, generally not meaningful. That being the case, and I happen to agree that you're very likely correct about that, even though I don't know very much about these specific issues, when we try to make comparisons around all kinds of tax issues between states, they're very, very difficult to make for exactly the reasons that you suggested. You also suggest that trying to figure out the effectiveness of programs over time may not be meaningful. What would be methods, or are there methods that are possible for determining effectiveness over time? We'll compare Oregon to Oregon over time with a new program or a new approach or a new level of enforcement. How would you go about figuring out whether these new efforts, which cost more money and more effort, whether they're actually worth doing or not in terms of taxes actually received?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question and a source of many a dissertation.
I suspect.
I think it was 11, we had another budget note that asked us to look at the effectiveness of the department's compliance programs. And we devised a way to specify which of the dollars that come into the department are received directly due to the department's enforcement action. And so there's a bunch of weasel words in there that I'm partly glossing over. But it's the biggest one is the directly due to, because without any enforcement, it's likely that the revenue base would erode to zero over time. And so most of the impact of the department is indirect.
Greece, for example.
Indeed, Mr. Chair. And so we have a way to specify, based on the source of the known liability, whether it comes from known non-filers being assessed tax, from audit assessments of tax, or from self-assessed tax. We have kind of differing algorithm for each of those sources to say it's most likely that these dollars would not have been received without direct action by the department's staff. And so the graphs on the screen now show the results of those specifications for the last 6 years. And the first one is the split between corporate and personal, and the second one is the personal income tax split into enforced filing deficiency and self-assessed debt. And so what we can observe is the impact of the agency's direct actions. But I would caution, even looking at this, what might not look like improvement or what might look like kind of going backward may be misleading, because if we were to do more farm audits,
right,
we would have less direct impact, but presumably the induced effect of other people with farm income knowing that they're more likely to be audited, and the members of the families of people who were audited hearing about their terrible audit experience, those indirect effects would lead to more self-assessed and paid on time tax that we can't measure. Even if you ask taxpayers, why did you pay the correct amount on time, you're probably not going to get a useful answer out of most of them.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the onset of the presentation, you mentioned complexity, and I'm just curious if there's a measure of it. Is it if so, where do we fall on that list?
Chair's representative, Oregon's complexity is partially reduced because we start with federal taxable income. And when I say partially reduced, I mean compared to other possible bases. But, of course, that also means that all of the complexity of the federal tax is subsumed into Oregon's tax. On the federal side, the Government Accountability Office has tested tax preparers who should know more about taxes than the average citizen, and they found something like 17 in 19, very limited test, maybe not generalizable, but 17 in 19 had the wrong refund amount for the scenarios that they set up. The last time Money Magazine did a test, it was 1998. We've probably gotten more complex since then. They sent an intentionally complex scenario out to 46 tax preparers, and they got 46 different answers as to the tax owed in that scenario. Oregon kind of grabs on to all of that federal complexity, and then every Oregon program that adds a subtraction or has an addition or every new credit adds to the complexity. It makes it harder for taxpayers to file correctly if they want to, and it also provides an avenue for people to fudge a little with the numbers if they want to.
Wow, that's pretty shocking. Did they list the accountants and where they stood on the spectrum? That could be marketing.
Madam Chair, the Money Magazine article does talk about the highest refund amount and the highest tax owed. And the GAO report, there's actually been a couple of them. They actually do a graph of the refund amounts recommended by each of the tax professionals, but I don't remember those exact numbers.
I want to see names.
What?
Were you done?
No, he's not.
I just had a follow-up. I guess in listening to all this, did you make a list of the things that we should be focusing on? In other words, where can we spend our money the most wisely?
Chair's representative, the second part of the presentation was the strategy to address the gap, and I don't want to speak for the program managers, and it's not necessarily obvious that the highest points of misreporting are the place to focus on, but generally, if we're able to kind of keep in mind both the direct and indirect impact of enforcement efforts, then we can maximize the return to things like audits. But it's also it's difficult to, as we were discussing, and it's kind of difficult to know exactly what those indirect impacts are, and so there's a bit of an art to it. And really the program managers would be the best source for that information.
I guess, Madam Chair, I was just wondering where complexity fit. If you're basically saying forget trying to fix the complexity, it's hopeless. Instead, let's just try to enforce, make these people pay, even though we don't know quite what that amount should be. Is that what I'm hearing? And I'm being mean, but that's what I'm hearing.
Chairs, a representative, feel free to be mean to me. That's what I'm here for. In designing a tax system, there's ways to make it less complex or more complex, but there's a bunch of policy choices there. And historically, the department hasn't spoken up much on those policy choices. But if you think about a retail sales tax, which I'm not advocating, I'm just bringing up as an example. If you think about a retail sales tax, you can impose that on the gross receipts, the gross retail receipts. You can impose that on retail receipts minus food. And just that little part where it says minus food increases the complexity and reduces the compliance. You could also just impose the tax on retail square footage. And then you have trade-offs in the neighborhood of ability to pay versus benefits received. And those are kind of difficult policy choices. And so what other states have done, some other states have decoupled from taxable income and moved back to adjusted gross income. And that reduces complexity by eliminating a bunch of the deductions, the Schedule A deductions, and those types of things, and allows a lower rate, but you have winners and losers from those types of changes to complexity. It's a very grand problem.
Representative Barnhart.
It occurs to me, and this is, I will admit, somewhat facetious, I wonder if the IRS could do those kinds of surveys you were describing of tax preparers and then be particularly careful about auditing the ones who whose reports showed the lowest taxes, ignoring the ones, of course, that showed the highest taxes, because you might not want to find out the direction in which they were wrong.
Mr. Chair, they have limited resources with which to send probably dummy returns to every preparer in the country to do that kind of testing.
I knew it was a bad question.
But it is a fair question. They probably have found correlations in the type of preparer, because there's differences between enrolled agents and CPAs and attorneys. They've probably found differences there, and hopefully they use those to focus their resources.
Earlier we heard that the estate tax had come in a lot lower than anticipated. And did this compliance report look into this estate tax, and are there any particular things about that compliance that rise to the surface?
Madam Chair, that the estate tax was not a subject of this particular report, and I haven't given it enough thought to comment on it now. I apologize.
Okay, thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a reference for the members of the committee and those listening that there was a very interesting NPR story about 2 weeks ago on tax compliance that some of you may have heard about tax compliance around the world, and two jurisdictions that have had issues are the Philippines and Italy. And the Philippines have taken a new tact with the tax commissioner, has become something of a national celebrity. She appears on commercials with flames behind her and carrying automatic weapons and talking about how she's going to bust down your door. And her strategy is she has prosecuted the highest profile celebrities in the Philippines regularly over the last 2 years. And now paying taxes has become cool in the Philippines, because you don't want to end up like those celebrities getting busted on their yacht by the Philippine tax commissioner. So just an idea for the Department of Revenue. Maybe check out what the Philippines are doing.
Other questions? Thank you very much. And I understand this report was also given during the session to the Ways and Means Committee as well.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Next one, Christine's going to come up, okay. But Chris Fick, and then Tom Petowski.
Okay. We'll close the hearing on tax compliance, and we will open the agenda item on Oregon property tax capitalization. And we have Christine here, and then Chris comes up first.
Okay, great.
Welcome. Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today there is a group here from the Northwest Economic Research Center to talk about the ways in which maybe another side or perspective on Measure 50 inequities that happen. And this report would focus specifically on the Portland area. It is available in OLIS. The full report is there. And they are here today, Tom Petowski, Jenny Liu, and Jeff Renfro from the Northwest Economic Research Center will present on the capitalization of the differences in property tax that can happen due to Measure 50 into the actual value of the houses. So there's an inequity in the amount of tax paid, but also an inequity that it gets built into the property value when it's bought or sold.
Okay, why don't we bring our panel up?
Sorry, I'm going to jump ahead in the queue if I might. Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. Good morning to the rest of the committee, and thank you for holding this informational hearing on a report that we had commissioned that, as Ms. Broniak described, looked at the way in which a property tax system is affecting home values with a focus on the Portland metropolitan area. Before I hand it over to the economists, I just want to briefly describe what our rationale was in requesting the study and then let them dive into the analysis and the results. As this committee knows, the League has long advocated for reforms to our property tax system. For the past two full legislative sessions, we pushed for referrals that would empower local voters to pass local option levies outside of statewide tax caps. As many of you know, voter-approved temporary levies for services are the first things reduced under measures 5 and 50, and we think local voters should be empowered to determine the level of services for their communities. This committee may be interested to know that just last week in the May primary, voters approved 16 out of 21 local option levies. That's a 76% success rate. And statewide, if you include bond and new taxing district measures, 31 out of 42 property tax measures passed statewide. So we know when local voters are given the opportunity to fund services at the local level, they are willing to take advantage, even if it means higher taxes. However, because of those statewide tax caps, revenue lost to local option levies is increasing as well. Last year, revenue losses exceeded $212 million on local option levies. That's a $27 million increase from the year before. Similarly, the inequities caused by measures 47 and 50 have been a priority for the League, and we would like to see some sort of recalibration in the assessed value determination that was created by measure 50. Just by way of review, measures 47 and 50, which I, like Ms. Broniak, refer to singularly just as measure 50, Measure 50 did three things. Created permanent tax rates for all existing taxing jurisdictions. It created a separate assessed value by looking at your property's 1995, 96 real market value and subtracting 10%. And then it pegged the rate of growth in assessed value at no more than 3% annually. And a fourth thing that Measure 50 didn't do, and which I just referenced, is recalibrate the assessed value at any time. There are about 20 states that have a similar separate assessed value for tax purposes like Oregon does, so that folks don't see tax increases of 8, 10, or 12%. But of those 20 states, it's only Oregon and Arizona that never recalibrate, and particularly don't recalibrate at the time of sale. We never use that change in ownership that free market transaction as an opportunity to determine assessed value and recalibrate at that time. And a Lincoln Institute report said that out of all the property tax limitation systems in existence, Oregon has gone the farthest in separating assessed or taxable value from real market value. So the ramifications of these policy decisions nearly 20 years after Measure 50 are pretty well understood, certainly by this committee. You have properties that have grown well in excess of 3% a year. You have properties that, due to their assessment cycle, hadn't even been assessed until the early 90s because they were assessed on a six-year rolling basis. So when assessed value was locked in the mid-1990s, there's no way for us to recalibrate or change what the property's value was then, regardless of how it's appreciated in the 20 years since. There have been a couple reports that have examined this and shown how widespread it is. Your Legislative Revenue Office did a report in 2009 that looked at four counties to see these horizontal inequities, Multnomah, Deschutes, Sherman, and Jackson County, and found widespread discrepancies in property taxes for all property values in all four of those counties. And many of you have seen the great GIS maps that Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue put together, which show the level of discount that Measure 50 affords certain properties, with folks in blue, if you recall those maps, getting a discount in excess of 50%, and folks in red essentially receiving no property discount as a result of Measure 50. So the question we had in our mind and why we commissioned this study was, well, how is the market capitalizing on that those huge discrepancies? If you're going to go out and buy a house, you've got what you could pay monthly for a mortgage, and then you've got a bunch of different variables that determine what that amount can be. You've got your sale price, your down payment, your interest rate, the length of your loan, and then property taxes. And changes to any one of those variables can impact what you can pay monthly in a mortgage and impact the other variables in that monthly allotment that you have when you look at your housing expenses. So we wanted to see how efficiently the market was capturing this huge discrepancy. Was the dramatic property tax differences that we see between southwest Portland and northeast Portland, was the market effectively capturing those differences and increasing prices in certain neighborhoods? There are a lot of other variables that obviously go into buying a house, so we need to hire some PhDs to take into account what those might be. School quality, proximity to downtown, walkability, crime, the age, size of a housing stock, all those things needed to be determined to properly run a regression analysis and figure out how big of a factor property tax was. So we solicited the help of Dr. Tom Potowski and folks at the Northwest Economic Research Center to look into this. And with that, I'll hand it over to them. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Why don't we wait until the panel finishes, and then we'll hit y'all with our questions.
We're looking for the presentation. we got just have the PDF on there.
Well, I just lost OLIS on my computer. I don't know how to get it back, so I can't help you here.
I think I have it. It's pretty. It starts with Portland.
It's a pretty picture of Portland, yeah.
Yeah, we like it so far.
I'm working from the PDF. It seems to be fine.
Yeah, look at that beautiful picture.
Is the report?
Can you pass it up to
the night sky of Portland is just gorgeous, isn't it?
Can I go online and get it from my email?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll let you sit here. So we continue on. All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of Senate and House committees. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski. I am director of the Northwest Economic Research Center, located at Portland State University. And Today, I'm going to go over a few items, sort of introductory as we move in here, and I've tried not to repeat some of the stuff that Chris already provided for you. But I think it gives just sort of a background as to how the study came about and some of the nuances that we have with the property taxes. So really, you know, before 1990, you know, we were in what would be called a levy property tax system. You know, local governments would figure out what their budget needs are, take that amount, divide it by their district's total real market value, and they'd come up with a tax rate. And then that tax rate would be applied to individual properties to figure out what's the taxes paid or the taxes imposed for them. So at this point, there's really no difference between what we would call assessed property value and real market value at this time. Now, what happened in the 1980s? It wasn't the best of economic times. Properties that really didn't go up in value instead saw their property taxes rise as the budgetary needs of local governments went up. Now, there were generally limits of about 6% growth in levies per year, and many local governments went right up to the limit. So here you have tax rates are rising while property values are stagnating. Other districts that saw new construction had more properties to spread out the tax revenue needs, and so it's possible that existing properties might see their actual tax rates decrease during this time. So nothing wrangles Oregonians more than seeing unfairness. And so there was a need to do something about this. So come along 1990, Measure 5. So now Measure 5 places a limit on taxes paid. And you're all aware of this, the $5 per 1,000 related to schools and the $10 related to 1,000 per value of real market value related to general operating expenses for local governments. Now, the other thing that happened here is that if the taxes paid would exceed these limits, then tax rates were proportionally lowered to match the limits. So if you have taxing districts that didn't exceed their limits, no real changes from Measure 5. We're really back to the pre-1990 days. But if they did exceed the limits, we have what was been called compression, and tax rates would be proportionally lowered to the limits would hit. So what you have is you have a levy system. If you didn't hit the limits, if you were over the limits, you became a rate-based system because the rates then would calculate really what your taxes paid. So what happened, though, in the 1990s? Well, in the 1990s, population growth increases, house values go up, real market value goes up, and that's used in the denominator to calculate. And so even though you have the limits, if you have real market values going up, you're going to have taxes paid going up. So there was a need then to try to correct this situation. And then we come to Measure 50 in 1997. And I'm definitely going to simplify this rather than go into all the nuances.
Good luck on that.
Yeah. So we went from what was kind of a hybrid system of Measure 5, which was a levy system, and if you had compression, it was rate, to totally rate-based system. So 1997-98 became the base period for assessed values, and they used 90% of the real market value in the previous period, 95 through 96. So this was the first official decoupling of what is called assessed values and real market value, where before the two were essentially the same. And it's the assessed value that the taxes are applied to. So, and also new property that came in, as Chris mentioned, if it came in after 95, 96, they adjusted their assessed value to make them comparable to the assessed value back in that base period. So now tax rates become permanent. Those related to operating budgets, and I'm not going to go into all the various aspects of the other tax options that are available out there, but that's kind of the bulk of it, is the permanent taxes. And assessed property value was limited to only be able to grow at 3% per year. And the other part that happened that's kind of interesting given the financial meltdown and the housing meltdown is that if the assessed value should be above the real market value, then the real market value would be used as the base in the calculation with the tax rate. So you always use the lower of the two. So now we've created a property tax system that makes it near impossible for anybody to understand. And we also know that no good intended policy goes unpunished. Over time, and in our study, different neighborhoods in the Portland area have definitely seen different growths in their property values. So what you can have, very different assessed values compared to real market values. This means that we can have very different taxes imposed as a percentage of real market values of that property. So what we wanted to do was then, from the request from the League of Oregon Cities, investigate this gap, the gap between the assessed value and the real market value, and is that translated into the price of houses? Now, you can think of a house where you live as providing you with a stream of services. Shelter, there are schools nearby, proximity to amenities, public safety, and of course these services you have to pay for. And what we all hope is that in our personal calculation, the benefits of these services are greater than the costs that we have. Now, if two houses are very similar, but one has a higher, what we might say, net benefits compared to another, you could prefer that house that has the higher net benefits. In environmental economics work, they've looked at houses that are on the same street, built by the same builder, have the same square footage, they have the same schools, same police protection. But one side of the street looks out over a neighborhood of different houses in other neighborhoods. The other side of the street, there's nothing there. It's at the edge of a bluff. They look out over mountains and lakes and so on. And you can probably guess that the houses on the one side of the street have a higher price to them than the houses across the street that don't have the view. And what we basically say is that that view is capitalized into the price of the house. So likewise, the idea here is that if we have these different property taxes paid relative to the, you know, value of the house, the assessed value is much lower than the real market value, is that aspect being capitalized into the house and thus a higher price? And so with that, we will move on to Jeff.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center. So very briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we had to put together to make sure that we were isolating the effect of the property tax system. So we started with certified tax rolls from Multnomah County. These tax rolls gave us information about every property in Multnomah County, both about the tax applied to it, its valuation, and then also characteristics of the property themselves. During our study period, we had 4 years of certified tax rolls. There was an unusually high number of foreclosures and distressed sales during this period. So one of the first things we did was we worked our data set down to single-family homes and then condominiums intended for single families. We eliminated anything that we could define as a foreclosure or distress sale, any transaction that was not undertaken at arm's length. So we wanted to isolate individual sellers selling their homes to other individual sellers. In some cases, there was an intermediary financial institution, but as far as we could tell, we eliminated the ones in which there was some sort of weird thing happening there that would affect our results. We combine this with 13 years of home sales data. So Multnomah County tracks the real market value and the assessed value of all these properties. So we were able to attach, for each sale that occurred during our study period, we were able to attach information about the property itself. Then we needed to incorporate all of the other determinants of sale price into our model. So as was mentioned earlier, we calculated a neighborhood crime rate for each one of our neighborhoods. We included walk scores. Each property was assigned an elementary school catchment area. So we included school quality ratings into this. So we really, everything that we could find in the literature, we went out and found it for each one of these properties. So we're confident that we've isolated the effect of the property tax system. If we could go on to the next one. So we prepared a few maps to set up what we think the dynamic is. So these are Portland neighborhoods, and they're color-coded by the assessed value to real market value ratio. The warmer colors, the assessed value and real market value are closer to each other. The gray and the blue, there's a bigger gap between the two. So we can see that in the inner southeast area, and then in the close-in north and northeast areas, where we really see these large gaps. Where we see assessed value and real market value closest out in East Portland, but then also in the area around downtown. So this is motivated by a few things. So in places where the assessed value and real market value are close to each other, this could be real market value or the value of the property just has not increased as fast as it has in other parts of the city. It could also be related to the period when the development occurred. So in downtown, there's a lot more new development that came in after the new tax scheme was put into place. In eastern Portland, there's a mix of new development and then also properties that have just increased in value at a slower rate than other parts of Portland. And we think that this is what's driving the results we're going to show you. If you could go on to the next one, Jenny. So this is mean sale price by the same neighborhood categorization. Darker colors are higher mean sale prices. So you can see that these don't necessarily correspond to where we see the bigger gaps between assessed value and real market value. The effect is motivated by the speed at which real market value is moving away from assessed value, but that isn't necessarily happening in just wealthier neighborhoods. In areas where, in probably more desirable areas, that effect, there's a dynamic that's pushing that effect, but that's not the only thing that's driving this. Again, we see in the downtown area, we see generally higher sale prices, but the assessed value to real market value ratio is pretty close. And then our last one, to really drive this point home, this is also mean square footage of the sales during our study period. Again, this doesn't correspond to our assessed value to real market value ratio. We see in downtown, generally smaller properties that people are buying, which is probably what you would expect. But then even in areas on the east side, the dark red areas that corresponds to the Irvington neighborhood and the area around that, and then that's Eastmoreland and the southeast area in the dark red. So these are places where property values are very high, but there isn't necessarily a big gap between the assessed value and the real market value. I'll turn it over to Jenny now.
For the record, Jenny Liu with the Northwest Economic Research Center. And so to give an even better idea of where we're seeing larger gaps versus smaller gaps, these are some of the neighborhoods highlighted. So for the highest AV-RMV ratio, meaning that these are the neighborhoods where they're paying property tax on a larger proportion of their real market value, these neighborhoods are mainly all concentrated on the outer east side of Portland, so more towards the newer development and areas where they're, as Jeff mentioned, they are experiencing slower growth. And they are paying around 80 something to about 90 something of their property value in terms of property taxes. On the other end of the spectrum, on with the lowest AV-RMV ratios, these neighborhoods, Boise, Vernon, Humboldt, King, Woodlawn, all of these are all concentrated in the north-northeast region of Portland. And these are the neighborhoods that we are, when we talk about the more gentrified neighborhoods, so north-northeast Williams Street, Alberta, Albina District, all of these are areas where they experienced rather low property values during the period when the assessed values were locked in the 95 to 96 period. And then they experienced very high growth after that period into the current period. So looking at just all of this data, there really is evidence suggesting that the inequities are not concentrated in particularly lower-priced neighborhoods or
or undesirable neighborhoods, that's not the case. So there's a variation that's sort of across the board, just depending on when the neighborhoods were developing and how much growth has been experienced since the passage of Measure 50. So our analysis, we did a little bit of regression using all of the data that that we assembled together. And some of the results, if we want to think about how much of the difference in property taxes are being capitalized or captured into property values, we were seeing about 15 to 92% capitalization, or that's how much of this difference is being captured in property values. So just to give a short illustration on the table that you'll see here, if we looked at an average house sold in Portland during our study period, this would be a house about 1,600 square foot selling for about $314,000. This house would have an AB to RMV ratio, or they would be paying about 65% of their property value in terms of property taxes. So for this house, if we were looking at the exact same house after controlling for all house characteristics, all neighborhood characteristics, and school characteristics, the difference in paying lower property taxes at, say, 55% of your property value, you experience a pretty large increase in your property values that's captured in your home values of about $4,000 to about $16,000 in sale price. And if you were paying higher than average property taxes, then you would experience a lower property value associated with that. And so going through all of our data and analysis, we saw a lot of reasons for the horizontal inequity that can happen here. And that is some summary of where that actually occurs is that different neighborhoods or different houses might be capitalizing the property tax difference differently in different neighborhoods. So in some places, it is captured into the sale price, whereas in some other neighborhoods, it may not be. And also, there may be large differences in real market value growth, as Tom was mentioning earlier, and that some neighborhoods, they are experiencing a revitalization. They're growing, lots of demand for that particular neighborhood. That can also cause a large difference in whether or not these households are under compression. And also, as my colleagues have mentioned, the year built and when they were reassessed in the cycle prior to that lock-in of the 95 to 96 period, that is also going to be highly significant in accounting for the horizontal equity. So that, Tom.
So just you know, to summarize, as Dr. Liu mentioned, there isn't necessarily a true rhyme or reason. You know what I mean by in neighborhoods that have seen this differences in the property taxes they paid as a percent of their real market value, it tends to be rather haphazard as these inequalities are dispersed across different neighborhoods. The questions here are things of are we having certain property owners, given that the values of the properties have gone very high, are they having a sort of somewhat of a break on their burden of paying for services of local government relative to neighborhoods that have had their assessed value much closer to their real market value, thus their taxes paid are a higher percentage of their real market value. And then what about other parts of the state? We didn't look at other parts of the state, but our guess is that other places that saw a rapid increase in property values that had differences in neighborhoods, somewhat like Portland experienced. You could imagine places as Bend, Ashland, Medford could be the sort of places that might mirror the sort of effect that we found in the Portland area. takes questions.
You know, one of the things that comes up every time we start to discuss this issue is the idea that we don't reset the assessed value on sale, like California does. I'm not sure this was within the scope of your study, but if you're just looking at it from an equality standpoint, from an equity standpoint, would resetting on sale improve or worsen the inequalities between properties?
Madam Chair, there's not a straightforward answer. So, for example, in California, they do reset the assessed value on sale, which does also create another type of distortion in the market in that it's possible that houses may not come on the market as often, in that people want to hold on to their properties for as long as possible to really benefit from the lower property taxes that are assessed, for example, which could also cause inequities for, say, newcomers into the region or households that are up and coming, for example. So it's not really a straightforward answer that one is more equitable than the other, per se, but it is sort of outside the purview of our particular study.
Yeah. I think we've actually looked at this a little bit before, and there's some evidence that it would actually worsen the inequities, that you'd move inequities into a neighborhood-by-neighborhood scenario rather than just inequities between neighborhoods. Yeah. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I'm struck by the comment that we find the capitalization of property taxes into value in the Portland area ranges from 15 to 92%. That's a very wide range. Reminds me of a home improvement project where maybe if you do the kitchen or the bathroom, you get a 90% return on resale value. If you do the siding or you paint a room, you get a 15%. Can we generalize anything from a result that says there's a range from 15 to 92%? I'm just trying to take away any nugget. I mean, what I read into that is sometimes it matters, sometimes it doesn't.
Chairs, Representative Davis. So the reason for our wide range is it's really a result of the analysis process. So in the statistical analysis, so we're measuring the effect that AV-RMV ratio has on sale price. So they're different. So we can measure the effect of one on the other, but then they're also related to each other, right? Real market value is at least somewhat related to sale price. So it's just we have a statistical issue. So we can say that we're extremely confident that AVRMV is having an effect on the sale price, but then coming up with one number that we can give you, it's just we don't have the confidence, or based on a bias we know is in there, we feel more comfortable giving a wide range.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I think you know the nugget here is that it does matter. We have that large range, but no matter how you slice and dice it, the sensitivity of our analysis, different ways of looking at it, all comes out to point that property sale prices are affected by these differences in property taxes.
Thank you.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to just ask, I think it was Jeff, you who mentioned that you excluded foreclosures from this study. And I don't know what the statistical incidence of this is, but clearly since the housing market collapse, a lot of the appreciation in value seems to have been houses that were sold at foreclosure, then were done, you know, major remodels and sold at three times what they were sold for at the foreclosure sale. So, I mean, is that kind of property not included in this at all? Or when you say you're excluding foreclosures, did you include scenarios like that?
chairs, Senator Rosenbaum. We probably caught some of them. So because we had such a short period of time, what we were excluding was the front end of the transaction that you're describing. So if we thought that a person, for any number of reasons, was selling the house for an abnormally low price, we excluded that. If the house is then renovated quickly or is put back on the market and it comes back on and is sold as a normal transaction, then that second transaction would have been included. I would have to go back and look at how much of that was happening. I imagine we weren't catching, based on our time period, we probably weren't catching very many of the houses that came back on. We weren't catching that second transaction. We would just need another year or two of data to catch all of
okay.
that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So was the concept, or is something we can take away from this, that the system's not equitable? Or is that the wrong lesson? Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is figure out what to do with what I perceive to be an incredibly messy system. I don't pretend to understand it, and I've spent literally days working with our local assessors and other folks trying to figure this system out and make sense of it. I guess I'm asking, this study, what does it do for us? At what level? Does it say, yes, this system is not equitable? Or does it say, yes, here's a way we can try to attack this problem? How can we use that which you presented us with today best?
On the further research.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz. From our study, I think the conclusion is that there are inequities existing in the system. What it does not do is propose, say, a change or a way to fix the system per se. But I think with further research, if we were able to obtain data and assemble the data for more regions of the state to look at a wider range of what are the effects of this inequity on various regions of the state, we might be able to come to a more appropriate conclusion on how to change or alter the system to make it less complex.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz. So we've got a couple of things here in this system. I mean, definitely the inequity part is what we were asked to look at, you know, for the property taxes. The other part is, you know, a levy system before used to look at the needs of local governments, and that's how the tax was sort of set up and then the tax rate calculated. And so we've taken that part away to go to a rate-based system. So there's not a connection that strongly in the sense of the needs, whether they are true needs or not, of local governments and the taxes that are trying to be collected is one aspect. The other, and I know Paul has talked to you before about principles of taxation, you know, is it the benefit principle or is it the, you know, ability to pay principle? And so both of these are dinged by the present property tax system, where you have the possibility of people that are possibly able to pay a higher property tax are being assessed a lower property tax compared to someone in a comparable house. And then also the benefit principle. You're not, you know, it really is there's a decoupling of what the taxes are paid to whatever benefits you're getting from living in a particular taxing district. So unfortunately, that, you know, we don't have a solution, but it's really the study to point out that we do have these problems.
So I appreciate the comments. The points, the 5 points that you just made, the function of this study in the context of those 5 points, very helpful to me. But it's, I don't see it here. So can you email it to us or something so that we can say, oh, I see, this study helps us in recognizing that the elements of taxation are not being met by virtue of our current system, and this little study helps in these areas. You know, it's like attacking an elephant with a spoon. It's just hopeless. But at least it's a start. So I appreciate the study.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, and once again, these would be implications in that we haven't directly in the study made and looked at these aspects, but we they are implied.
This is another piece of the puzzle. The first thing I've been chair since 2008, and I think the very first hearing I had was on this very issue. We did it in Tigard, and we did have people from around the state, and you're absolutely correct, to make any kind of reasonable policy recommendations, we really do have to have a statewide perspective. But I think the Portland situation is a microcosm, and it certainly is consistent with all the other data that we've received. We did do some of the assessors did some analysis of Deschutes County and Multnomah County and I think Lane County, and found exactly what you're talking about. They didn't analyze the house price differential, and that's an interesting aspect of this. But the issue of the inequity goes beyond that, just in terms of fairness to taxpayers, especially given that for all other areas of taxation, there's a constitutional protection against unequal treatment. And that protection was that Measure 50 specifically exempted itself from that requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. I understand from an economics point of view why we want to know whether these differences in property taxes are capitalized or not. And I think that what you've told us is that the capitalization process is not very efficient, or the market's not very efficient in this area, kind of leading off of Representative Davis's comment. As policymakers around the issue of establishing a fair tax system in Oregon, why should we care about this study? I mean, I think we should, but it's not clear to me how this helps us with our task. Do you have some thoughts about that question?
You have thoughts? I have thoughts.
Chair Barnhart. Representative Bentz mentioned at some point you had taken a few days to try to understand the system. We have to go through the same process, and presumably we are people who are predisposed to understanding this. And I mean, it took us a while to figure out all the nuances.
You mean the ones you got to?
Yeah.
I mean, so one thing we took away from this is that the system is so complicated. And when even we, just in reading, we would hear elected officials and policymakers making comments about the tax system where we would say, you know, that's actually not correct. So, I mean, the lack of understanding is a big part of it. But then I think what we've discovered is that there is a benefit to certain people in Portland, certain property owners in Portland, that has nothing to do with any sort of policy objective. It's really arbitrary.
Right.
So from a policymaking perspective, having a system that is easier to understand, and then if you understand it better, you can actually use the system to try to obtain specific policy objectives, which the current system is just you wait 10 years and then you study it and you see, okay, surprise, you know, this is what ended up happening.
Representative Bentz.
A word in my defense. I actually spent, or maybe not in my defense, I actually spent more than 2 days on this. I repeatedly spent weekends on this.
Yeah.
Because I spend my weekends in this building during the session. And so, and then I spent time with our various county assessors trying to figure out, and I found exactly what you said, their understanding is mixed. And so if one of the elements that's on the list I hope to receive from you is understanding, it would be, in my opinion, right at the top, because I don't think it's understandable by most. So I would hope that that all the work that you've done results in at least a little summary of some of the main problem points that you've identified in reaching this ultimate result, not necessarily solutions, just problems.
I think there is a growing understanding in the public of, maybe they don't know the details or the nuances, but there is a growing understanding that about the inequities. I'm hearing more from my constituents. I think a lot of us are, especially when the property values declined and they didn't quite get below the assessed value, so people found their property taxes still going up 3% a year, even though their property value was down. And then they said, unfair, unfair, and a lot of them had actually voted for this, so be careful what you vote for.
Could I just quickly add a final, for me at least? I really appreciate your comment about complexity. I think the things that most degrade the trust and regard for government and its work in society has to do with the fact that people cannot understand what we're doing. It is ironic, of course, that some of the worst problems we have come about as a result of the initiative process that the government doesn't control. We have including the measures that we're talking about, Measure 5 and Measure 47. But I really do appreciate the point, and of course you cut right through all the issues when you say the complexity is too high, we've got to do something to deal with that issue. And even something that isn't top-notch, that is simple and easy to understand, would be better than what we have now. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you very much for this report. It adds an important element to the discussion, which is not over.
Yeah.
Thank you. Before we close this item, I wanted to give Chris Fick an opportunity, if you want to come up, if there are any questions that you particularly wanted to respond to from the city's standpoint.
Is there anyone here in this room that would have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Again, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities for the record. I guess the two primary questions I was itching to answer back there are around the purpose of this study again, and how Reset at Sale may factor into any improvements that we might see to the system. To the first point, what we wanted to illustrate is to continue to educate Oregonians about the ramifications of our property tax system. I think, like Madam Chair, like you said, more people are becoming aware of the discrepancies in property taxes that they pay annually. But I think for most people, it was illuminating to see that not only are you paying a disproportional burden compared to what your price is, what your home value is, but on the end of your purchase and the end of your ownership of the home, you're similarly either benefiting from the system or harmed by the system. In other words, the annual benefit or drawback that you experience through our property tax system doesn't start and end when you own your home. It continues with the house's purchase. The example that they gave in their table was illuminating, but let's think again about those homes that are in the blue neighborhoods where the property taxes are less than 40% of the real market value. Even with the 15 to 92% confident ratio, we're talking about a swing of between $9,000 and $30,000 in accrued value for that property. On the other end of the spectrum, you have folks that are in the orange and red neighborhoods where the value of their property is harmed between $3,000 and $10,000. So if you add those two amounts up, even with the wide variation, we're talking about a potential swing in what should be identically valued property of between $9,000 and $40,000. That's pretty significant for people's pocketbooks and in the decisions they're making. So we wanted to bring that to people's attention. In terms of whether or not Reset at Sale makes the system fairer, you know, fair, like beauty is an eye of the beholder, but if you're two people selling what should be similarly valued property, the idea that you are benefiting or being harmed by the property tax system seems somewhat unfair. So for purposes of people who are selling their property, they'll at least be on a level playing field. And if 18 other states have done it, it's at least some other attempt to capture what the market is deriving when it comes to property values. Last thing I'll say about California, the discrepancies there are a little bit more pronounced. their average rate of their growth is limited to 1% per year. Ours is 3%. So you would still certainly have a lock-in effect where people wouldn't want to move, but I don't think it would be as pronounced. And the only other state that doesn't reset at the time of sale, which I mentioned before, in addition to Oregon, is Arizona. And they at least tether what your taxes are to your real market value. So if your real market value grows at a faster rate, so too does your assessed value. They call the two different things. They don't recalibrate, but the two are being pulled along together so that the gap is closing proportionally. Whereas in Oregon, you've got 3% growth. Regardless of what happens to real market value, it can run away wherever it goes. There's no reconnection or tethering, if you will. So with that, I really appreciate the opportunity to
clarify. Thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate it. All right. We will close this agenda item and open our agenda item on review of the 2014 revenue measures passed.
See you later.
This should be good.
I'm sorry.
Talk about complexity.
Sure, I can see people leaving for the exits.
Yep.
Not because of you.
I know.
No,
I don't take
over,
it personally.
But
actually, members, we anticipated this may be the buffer part of the agenda. So I just wanted to draw your attention to some of the material. At the end of each session, we do prepare our revenues measures passed. This, of course, is one of our thinner versions because of the February session, but just to refer that to you and let us know if there's any questions you have. I found the most useful thing of this is historically I tend to look at these more 10 years from now, and it kind of reminds you what some of the decisions were made and the kind of things that were considered together. The only other thing I would comment on, the Department of Revenue produces very useful summary reports on the major taxes, and they've just issued their 2014 editions for the personal income tax and the property tax, so we've got some copies of those for you, and those are also online and they're from their research department, and they have a later in the year they'll come up with their updated version for the corporate income tax. So that's all we have on the agenda.
Okay, any questions? Okay, no
for
questions.
For your summer reading.
Right. Great summer reading.
Would you care to adjourn, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Interim House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
And the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned. Thank you, committee. All right.